Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. You guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, January 17th, 2016. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on iTunes and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind and, more importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 152. I have a very special guest, first guest of the new year, Mr. Pete Dominic, a comedian, radio host, and father. More importantly, he's a dad. Really good comedian. We're going to get to him in a bit, and we had a great conversation. I'm going to bring that to you in a few minutes. Right now, I have my TV on mute. I just finished watching the Carolina Panthers beat the Seattle Seahawks. So happy that they did that. Got a little nervous at the end because they didn't score any in the second half. They didn't score at all, and they let Russell Wilson come back. He's a gamer. And, you know, you can't win the Super Bowl by doing that unless you just, I don't know. It's going to be pretty crazy next week. That Green Bay Cardinals game last night was, a circus, to say the least. It was crazy. I don't know, man. I'm very nervous about. Now that I'm emotionally invested in Cam Newton and the Panthers to win, I'm kind of on edge. And, you know, my dad sent me a text and was like, yeah, it's almost over. The fat lady is about to sing. She's waking up. I'm like, yeah, dad, but Russell Wilson is a G. The homie Gordon Baker Bone, a friend of the podcast on Twitter, he tweeted, what did he say? He said something like, what did he say? He said, I honestly believe Russell Wilson can turn water into wine. And I was like, I said, yeah, black baby curl. His curls, I called him black baby curl Jesus, because his curls are just on point. And he's a savior, just not this time. But Russell Wilson's a hell of a quarterback. I just feel like this is Cam's year to do it. And I hope it happens. Hashtag black quarterbacks forever. Bury me in a Doug Williams jersey. Yeah, man. So I hope that happens. I can give you some dates. I'm going to be doing comedy. I will be on January 25th. I'll be at Littlefield doing the Night Train show with Wyatt Cenac. I don't think Wyatt's going to be there. Aparna Nancherla, friend of the podcast, will be guest hosting for Wyatt, and it should be a fun show. Always fun times at Littlefield. January 30th, I'll be at Cantina Royale in Brooklyn, New York at 8 o'clock p.m., and I'll be over at Gotham Comedy Club at 10:45 p.m. That's also on the 30th of January. And I'll give you a couple February dates. I'll be at the February 5th, the Experiment Comedy Gallery in Brooklyn, New York, 8 p.m., February 6th at Bistro B in Westport, Connecticut. And February 10th, I'll be at 2A in New York City at 8 o'clock p.m. So those are a few dates. For more dates, you can check out chrislambert.com. And all those dates will be under upcoming comedy shows. Had a fun week. I had two auditions. That was fun. One that I found out about the day before, that was a voiceover audition. I thought for a major office retailer, and I had to turn in something, and it was really fun. It reminded me of my days recording a fake radio show in my youth. I used to, I'm not going to tell you the title because it's kind of embarrassing. This was my radio show was a product of me listening to a lot of Paul Mooney and Keith Murray rap songs. So if you can imagine what that would be like, then I think you'd have a gist of what that show would have been, what that show was. So it reminded me of that. I was doing different voices and stuff. And I hope, I don't know, if I don't get a call back, if I don't get it, it's fine. I want to get it. But I felt, you know, when you turn something in, like if you turn in a TPS report or anything of artistic value, something that you know you did a good job on, it was just like, it was just flames. Like I knew it was dope. So we'll see what happens. But I like the fact that I accepted the challenge of the audition. I turned something in and it was cool. So I'm trying to give you the realness of someone that's on the fringes of show business in the industry, trying to break in, trying to use my pickaxe like Lara Croft climbing up Mount Everest and trying to make my way into the industry. I don't know why I use the female heroine, but I think she is, I think, honestly, if we want to get really nerdy about it, I would say, and I think I've went on record before with this, I would say that Lara Croft is one of the best action heroes in video game history. One of the best. She's got to be one of the top. I mean, I think Nathan Drake, I'm not super familiar with Uncharted. I've played a few minutes of it, about an hour or so of one of the games. I think Uncharted 3 or 2. I don't even remember. It's a very good game, but Lara Croft came first. First comes Indiana Jones. I mean, maybe you could make an argument for the Pitfall guy with the Atari in the arcade game, but I would say Lara Croft, Indiana Jones, Lara Croft, then maybe Nathan Drake. And then you got to throw in Joel and Ellie from The Last of Us in some form or another. But anyway, that's me trying to, you know, do my thing. And I have to keep you guys updated on that. So your boy is trying to do his thing and probably have some good news to tell you towards the end, probably next week. What else I can give? Let's do some. Oh, so I want to shout out to Tom Grassi and Frank Pellegrino for having me on their show, Comedy Chaos at Lucy's Lounge in Pleasantville. Always love going there because when I go there, I get to go see a movie before the show and have a good time. And I'll give you a movie review. So I went to the Jacob Burns Film Center, one of my favorite movie theaters of all time. And I saw a new film, called Anomalisa, and it's a fantasy drama film, all stop motion captured, I believe. I think that's what they call it. I'll read you the blurb. Michael Stone, husband, father, and respected author of How May I Help You Help Them, is a man crippled by the mundanity of his life. On a business trip to Cincinnati, where he's scheduled to speak at a convention of customer service professionals, he checks into the Frigioli Hotel. There, he is amazed to discover a possible escape from his desperation in the form of an unassuming Akron-based goods sales rep, Lisa, who may or may not be the love of his life. And I'll just leave it there. This movie, I believe, got nominated for Best Animated Film. And it is written by Charlie Kaufman, directed by Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. And all the nerds are excited about this movie. I saw it and I liked it. But I kind of, it's good. And it's a little, some parts are a little off-putting, but then I know why it was off-putting because it was I felt like it was the director's, it was the creator's choice, and I got why they were doing what they were doing. So I was like, okay, I see what you're doing, and I fuck with it. It's fine. It's good. It's a good movie. Artistically, it's really great. And one of the best sex scenes that I've seen in a film, probably at least one of the best sex scenes I've seen in 2015. And you could say, but Chris, it's stop motion animation. I say, I don't care. I got a little turned on. Can't front. Because it was interesting. It was something to see. This is not your world team. What the hell is that South Park guy? Team America? America? What the hell is it? I should know this. Team America? Oh my God. World Force? The Trey Stone and Matt Parker movie? And of course, now that I'm trying to find it, Team America, World Police. It was it wasn't like that. It was a little more sensual and kind of real. And when you look at the trailer, if you look at the trailer of the movie or some of the little blurbs about it, they'll say, oh, the most real movie of the year and yada, yada, yada. It's a little bit of they kind of size it a little bit. But there were moments that I was just like, oh, shit. And I got a little turned on at that the sex scene. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to be honest with you. That's what it's all about. So I recommend it, but it's not something that you need to run out there and see. I think if you're looking for something, if you've seen most of the Oscar nominated films, you'd probably be interested in seeing it. If you just want to see what's going on, but you could wait to see this on demand. I think you could wait, but, that's my opinion. And I'm sticking to it. Music. I was listening to Torre's album, who's an MC from Brooklyn. He's got an album called Entitled, and it just got released, I think, Thursday, early release. And it's dope, man. Torre is a beast. And I remember seeing him open for Little Brother and Evidence in Brooklyn back in 2007, and I had no idea who this was, and he just fucking killed. Like, he's just a strong MC. He's got bars all the way through. The album's dope. Fonte has a guest appearance on there. Feral Monch, Mac Wilds. It's just all around just really good ass boom bap hip hop, dope beats, dope rhymes. What more could you want? So Torre and Entitled, Entitled, something like that. Yeah, Entitled. I was right. All right, I was never good at spelling. I could spell, but I wasn't great. I didn't do well under pressure at spelling bees. Okay. So Oscars. Everybody's, you know, what is the Oscar so white thing, but you know, the silver lining in it is that Chris Rock is a host, and that opening monologue is going to be lit. I'm excited to hear what Chris says, and he's probably going to slam everybody. My big thing was the fact that Will Smith got snubbed, because I just knew usually Golden Globe nomination in that best actor category is usually usually a precursor to who's going to win the Oscar, who's going to get nominated at least. And they threw him out and put in Matt Damon for The Martian, which I haven't seen, but I heard is good. But I thought Will Smith, you know, like I said a couple weeks ago, I thought he did a great job. And it just seems like this probably does have something to do with race a little bit. You know, Will was this mega, super mega star fighting aliens, doing these huge box office numbers. Now he's just trying to, you know, settle in and just be just still a star, but somebody who's trying to expand. And it just seems like he's not getting it. Like the box office isn't treating him right. I always say, just because the movie doesn't make a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad film. A lot of people hated Focus. I didn't hate it. I don't know why, but I thought it was fine. And I thought if George Clooney or Brad Pitt chose to make a film that was, you know, outside of the box, and really Concussion is, I mean, it puts me in the mind of, like I said it before, The Insider, those like true to life stories. And, you know, it was a little paint by numbersy, but The Insider had a little more grit to it. And I think The Insider is a much better movie, but it was in the same vein. It's like it was Concussion was Modern Family to The Insider's Arrested Development, if that makes sense to you. Like Arrested Development, great, fantastic show. Modern Family, good, very good, above average, you know. So yeah, I think Will Smith is getting a bad rap because they're just saying all of his movies stink. And I think part of it was Focus. He was making out with a white woman. And we still hold on to those things that some of us still hold on to those things, and it's not cool. You still hold on to those old values, and some people still aren't cool with that sort of thing. So I'm going to be talking about that in more depth with my good friend J.L. Covan on his podcast, The Righteous Prick. We'll get into that. Probably going to record an episode tomorrow, and it'll be released Tuesday. And of course, when it comes out, I'll definitely tweet it out for you, and so forth, and all that jazz. So let's get to Pete Dominic. Pete Dominic is a radio host, a comedian. He hosts a daily radio show, actually, called Stand Up with Pete Davidson, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Let me just hold on a second, guys. Okay, yeah, it is Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern. So it's Pete's a really funny guy, and I met him at Levity Live, and which I would say is just my home club in West Nyack, New York. Met him, worked with him a bunch of times, and he's just one of those dudes that's a pro all around, terrific comic, very funny, very autobiographical, very open, honest, and just a really good comic. And I went over to his house, his wonderful home in Rockland County after work, and we just sat down and had a good conversation. So we talked about a bunch of things. So here it is, my conversation with the very funny Pete Dominic. So you do like therapy? You're into it?
Yeah, I went. I was forced to go when I was a young man, when I was a teenager, because my brother had a drug issue. And so okay. The family therapist thought we should all go. And I thought I'd be talking about my brother and his drug issues in my family. But I spent every session talking about the girls that I liked and had crushes on, and then kind of complained about why they didn't like me back. Like that chapter of my life is titled Unrequited Love with a Therapist to Help Me Through It.
I could have used that. I could have used therapy.
It's the greatest. Therapy is the greatest.
It's just like, Dad, I like her, but she's... Well, you should have played football.
Yeah. Really?
He would just
give you one sentence, things, and you would sulk into your room like that was an option.
I was real... I guess I was kind of like an...
Should have been a jock.
Yeah, pretty much. He said that before, but not after school special.
There's a big difference between talking to your parents or even your spouse versus a therapist or a friend.
Sure, of course.
And so I went years, then I went for years without it. Then when I was 24 and I've been doing stand up a few years, I was stumped. I couldn't write any new material. I couldn't come up with any new material. And I said, I want to lock myself in my apartment for 2 weeks and just write. And after 2 weeks, I came out with no new material, because that's when I realized if you want to be, for me, my style of comedy, you know, it's very autobiographical. If I want to be good, I have to live. I have to do crazy things, have experiences, as many different experiences as I could.
Right.
And that's when I went like on the offense. I was like, I'm going to go to a therapist. I'll get material from that, because stuff will come up, shit will come up. But of course, it turned into a super healthy thing for me as a man at the time. And I've gone back and forth, and I've had three, four therapists over my life.
I think more men need to do that, women. Or just express express themselves more, because I think it's helpful. So you don't lash out and you don't end
up. It's so obvious. I always equate it to exercise. Mm-hmm. So do you think exercise is a good thing?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think eating right is a good thing? Mm-hmm. Then therapy is a good thing. It's just mental exercise. You got to go once a week just to maintain, or once, you know, every month. And then you have to do other things too. You have to meditate. You have to get your mind right. Yeah, you have to get your mind right the same way you get your body right. No doubt about it. And it doesn't just come.
Were you like that? What were you like before therapy? What was pre-therapy Pete like?
My role was the superhero, the therapist told me. He identified me and my family.
Were you the older brother?
No, I was the younger brother. Who put on his cape and made everybody laugh and mm-hmm. solved everybody's problems by just distracting them and entertaining them. Yeah, that's who I was, that kid.
And was it just you and your brother or other siblings as well?
Just my older brother. I have a brother who's two and a half years older than I am. Yeah, we're super close still.
That's
always
good.
Yeah, it's pretty much. But he is my best friend.
I kind of envy that dynamic of a brother or just sibling dynamics, because it was just me.
Wow, man.
Parents were older.
Really?
And my dad was 38, mom was 36.
Wow.
So it was kind of like an accident. When my mom used to get mad at my dad, she used to say, you know, your daddy was like, are you going to keep it? He said that, you know.
Oh,
but they never treated me like an accident. So
they treated you like their little miracle baby, their little blessing maybe?
I would say that I was spoiled. But then when I turned 16, I got a job, you know, because I wanted a PlayStation. So it was just like a natural progression.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to grow up in an only child. But the books that have been written about it, the studies that have been done on it are fascinating. And I'm not sure that it predicts any one thing, but you know, you can just imagine.
I was talking to
a lot of play dates. Did they always hook you up with, like,
well, see, the thing that family, I didn't have.
You're black. You probably had a lot of cousins that you played with.
Yes, but they were actually, I'll get to that, because I was actually having this conversation with a coworker this week, just talking about her son who's 11 years old, and she was talking about the trouble he was having in school, and he's a like a sweet kid. I've met him before, like, take your sons and daughters to work day. Sweet kid, nice kid, goes to this new school, and he's just kind of having difficulties fitting in. He's an only child. And I was asking, like, well, what does he do? I told her if he had an activity or something that he liked, like, does he like soccer? Does he like music? Something to immerse himself in.
Make his own porn.
Make his own porn.
You know, he's a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And if he's somewhere as a kid.
I mean, with these iPhone 6s, you can do whatever you want.
Lighting.
Yeah. So you might even get picked up by Jon Favreau.
Oh, wait, what?
Because he was in that commercial. He was like, what? This is a student film? Get these kids on the phone. You're already looking at the video on the phone.
How much of a nerd I am. I actually instantly thought of Jon Favreau, the White House speechwriter, worked for Obama, and now is out in Hollywood writing scripts. One of the most famous film directors, Jon Favreau, with the same name.
One of my
favorite movies, not to go
Swingers?
Too far off on a tangent. Yeah.
Dude, that movie was so – it's just – I don't know. It's
an original talk about it, I would imagine. Everything's been said about that film.
Well, right? It's just a classic. That was around the time, I guess, what was that, like 97, 98?
Sorry about my dog barking.
I didn't hear it.
We're in my house.
I didn't hear it.
Yeah, she's got a bark collar on.
Yeah, explain her bark collar.
Well, we don't like her when she barks, especially.
Indy's your dog.
Her name is Indy, yeah. That's a Havanese. It's hypoallergenic. That's hair, not fur. And she wears a collar that, if she barks, a citronella spray comes out. And so it works. So she doesn't bark anymore.
And it doesn't hurt.
Not at all. Oh. I mean, it smells pretty good. So almost. But I mess with her. And I mess with people all the time. Like, the girls have their friends come over, and I put the collar, not around their neck, but not tightly. And I just put it against their neck, and I make them bark, and a citronella sprays into their face.
Oh, really?
A lot of times those kids don't come back here. And a lot of times their fathers do.
No, surprised you're not locked up.
It's all good.
Right
now. No, she's this dog. I never had a dog in my life. I'm 40.
Really?
Okay. 3 years ago, we got a dog because we thought the girls desperately wanted one, and we thought it would really shake shit up. And my wife thought it would get me to leave, and that I would have to walk her.
Yeah.
She wants me out as much as possible. So it's been great. I really have enjoyed it. I love animals, so but I don't know what I'm doing. And she has to get her hair cut, and it costs $60, and I don't give anything to UNICEF.
Wow.
And so that moral,
yeah.
You know, this year I did, but like I pay a lot more for the dog's haircuts than I do to charity, and that's a major source of shame in my life.
Well, you already have you. It's not like you're a selfish person because you have two kids. You're taken care of.
Yeah. You could argue that's selfish. What with the population issues we have now, Chris?
Come on, anyway. Yeah. But I'll
take a shit all over any conversation.
I'm sure you will.
No, I'm an optimist.
But I get what you're saying because some people that with if they don't have a family, they get a
pet. The least selfish people adopt. The least selfish people in the world that want to be parents adopt kids. Those are the real heroes in humanity.
Okay.
I think.
I want to kind of nerd out a little bit because you kind of opened up a path with Swingers.
Mm.
And I would say that was 97, 98 when that movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
That's around the time when I first started really enjoying movies, where it used to be, for me, the progression was football, cards, basketball, video games. And then I started looking at release dates of movies when they were coming out. And my like going to the movie theater would be the movie's audition to me buying it on DVD or video.
You had a system.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How organized was that set of rules?
It was just if I liked it, you know.
You like sat in the theater with like a notepad and a monocle.
Oh no! It would just be
this movie will be purchased by me someday. This is a buyer. This one is not.
Yeah, like I would just if I saw the movie and I liked it, if I liked some aspect about it, I would get it. And
did
then
you have your own rating system, like the Rotten Tomatoes, like a Rotten Chris, like just you making a facial expression, like you had something spoiled. Like, yeah,
No. But that was I love movies and that was one of those movies.
I love movies too. I hear you talking about movies with other comedians and I get a little bit intimidated by the depth of knowledge that you and whoever you're talking to has. I certainly appreciate it and understand it. And in another world, I probably would have gotten even more into films. I love film.
Yeah.
And I can definitely talk about the films that I love. I get intimidated when you start talking about a film I'm not as familiar with, I don't remember the details of. And then I'm like, wow. Then I start getting insecure because I'm like, how do they remember all these details about these movies?
I'm not one of those guys that's like, oh, remember that line. And this, I just kind of, I'll remember certain
even
aspects
the plot,
of it.
Though, but I would have a hard time probably explaining the plot of certain films that I don't. What's that movie with Kevin Bacon on the river?
River Runs Through It?
No, that is a great movie with Brad Pitt and Robert Redford.
Oh, he's not in that.
The River Wild, maybe?
Okay.
I almost feel like he met Kira Sedgwick in it. I don't know. But that movie, I don't know why that movie was the one I went to at all.
Yeah, I don't know.
No idea where that came from, but I can't remember the plot. I know it was a river and Kevin Bacon was a bad guy. Some kind of kidnapping situation.
I vaguely remember that.
Hostage situation.
Yeah.
I think it was pitched probably as it's a hostage situation on a river rapids where a family is on a vacation. Kevin Bacon's character is a fugitive, and someone in Hollywood said, "Yeah, well, I'll pay a lot to make that.
Why not?"
Kevin Bacon's attached.
You touched on something that when we were working together, was it
your crotch?
No.
Oh.
We touched on. You're talking about movies and buying digital, like buying them on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that? Do you just...
Well, I always pay, if that's what you're asking.
Well, no, I'm not talking about...
Yeah,
I'm not
are
talking
you asking
about
if
steal.
I steal, if I'm a thief?
No, I'm just asking...
You're going to come into my home.
I'm just asking, like, what's your take on that? Because for me...
Where does my source, what is my source of film purchase? What are you asking me? What are you asking me? Get more specific.
Do you believe in digital or hard copy? Because part of me feels
All right. I feel like I have this debate. Yeah, you're on the wrong side of it.
I'm on the wrong side.
I think so, but I would love to hear you fight hard because I have this fight with my producer Alfred.
Okay.
On my radio show on Sirius XM, it's called Stand Up with Pete Dominic, Chris, and he is really nostalgic for hard copies of things. Mm-hmm. He insists upon having actual cases of DVDs, albums, CDs, and so on. And I understand that from the point of view of books, but mm-hmm. I really think books and films are far different because when you take down and you page through it, the book, mm-hmm. you have notes in it, you have pages, passages that you may want to refer to or remember. Whereas a film, it's just a case. It's just a cover. The media is tape or CD. There's nothing, right? I mean, give me the strongest possible pushback that you can.
My only thing was, I was talking about this last week on the last episode. I was talking about how, you know, you have a subscription to Amazon Prime and your Amazon Instant Video.
Yeah.
And if you buy that movie, it's kind of, you pay for it and it's on a server.
It's in a cloud. It's up in the sky.
Yeah.
Near rainbow.
I feel more comfortable.
It's in heaven.
If I bought something from the PlayStation Network, because it would be downloaded onto the system. Like it would be, it's.
You're worried that you're going to spend money and not access the media that at some point
kind
it's
going
to be just taken from you.
And then some.
That would be a fucking class action lawsuit if that happened. Yeah. Because you would be in a boat with literally millions of other people. They'd be like, wait, what happened to my movie? So that would be my answer to that.
Okay. And then
at least if that's the concern, as opposed to why want to even have anything anymore? Because you need to keep buying hard drives to store things on, right? Isn't that where you store it all on? All your movies?
Yeah. The PlayStation is essentially a hard drive now.
The concern should be, if that's the concern, when the Mad Max Thunder Road, Fury Road apocalypse happens, that if you're lucky enough to still have electricity, you can access all those films,
right,
but not the web, the cloud. So if you think that you're going to lose connection to the cloud, but again, I'm talking myself out of that one, because if you don't have internet access, you probably don't have electricity. And if you do have electricity, you're probably using it to boil water and get heat, not watch your movies, because you're in a sad post-apocalyptic era with no energy.
That's true.
And probably knowing you, with all due respect, you'll probably be killed right away, like at the very beginning.
I kind of think so.
I don't know. You seem like a pretty docile, buttoned-up guy who, if someone came at you physically with an axe, my feeling is you would put your arms up in front of your face, and he would ax your arms, and then
I would fight. I would put up a fight, but
do you think you'd
last I'd probably surprise myself at how long I last, but I'm not going to say
long. It's totally like hours or minutes, not days or weeks. You're not fast, Chris, is what I'm trying to say.
I'm not saying
you're not going to skedaddle away the way I will.
Yeah, we'll see.
Plus, I mean, unless it's a race war,
you just have a sexier corpse than me.
I'm not saying I'm going to last years. Uh-huh. I'll be killed within months of that. But yeah, plus, people will want to eat you.
People probably would want to eat me.
Yeah, I would.
But thanks. Thank you.
This is where I always want to get every podcast to cannibalism, where I'm eating the host, and so maybe now is a good time to wrap. It's over. I peaked. I got what I wanted.
Well, my only bounce back for that would be just some of the DVDs have features. Blu-rays have features like director's commentary, yada yada yada, deleted scenes.
That's
which isn't accessible.
Not accessible when you buy the movie on the cloud.
I don't think so.
That's surprising to me. I would think that they would want to be able to have that.
Like if you pay $15 for Trainwreck, it comes out, and all those Judd Apatow movies always have like behind the scenes.
Oh wow!
Featurettes.
Well, I never look at that stuff. You probably
never look at.
I never get. hard copies, probably, because I always just, And you know what? You've actually opened my mind on that, and that's really interesting because I always have loved, you know, deleted scenes, directors, commentary, but bloopers. I love a good blooper, Chris.
Yeah, I'm kind of a nerd.
Yeah, no, I like that. I'm a film. I just think, you know, it's interesting because you remember the things I said earlier. I get embarrassed. I can't remember plots and so on. You remember the things that you really, really love and that you really enjoy. And I love films. And I remember a lot about the films that I loved that stayed with me before I got into the space I am now professionally.
Right.
Which is, you know, like public interest radio.
Sure.
So I'm just constantly reading nonfiction. Is the best way to explain it, you know, and talking about that and anything from history to current, you know, public policy. And I love that stuff. And I nerd.
Sure.
I nerd out on that and not as much on films, but I always watch, when I watch movies, I watch them alone.
Me
almost
too.
Always. Just on the couch.
Yeah.
After the girls are in bed. My wife, we try to watch more together, but we have such different taste. She convinced.
Oh, really? Okay.
She just really, we couldn't agree on anything. And then finally she convinced me to watch Jurassic World, the newest.
It was fun.
Oh, God, was it bad. I mean, one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, the worst movie?
One of the worst because of, if you have that much money, you know, and you attach it to that storyline, it was just rough.
It's an amusement.
I love that, the male lead actor in that. He's a great actor.
Chris Pratt.
Yeah, he's great.
Chris
is fantastic.
He's a star.
Yeah, but I did not like that script.
I wouldn't care if I didn't see it again. It was just.
See, that's not one you're buying?
No. It would just be. It was when I saw that, it was a Friday, and I kill time before shows when I watch movies. I would say I'm a nerd. I was talking to a comic last night after a show, and we were just talking about, like, Comic-Con, and something really clicked for me last year when I was like, I get people like their superheroes, they like their nerd stuff, and it clicked for me when I went to this concert from this rapper named Sky Zoo, who's a friend of the podcast, who's been on the show.
Sky Zoo?
Yeah, he's from Brooklyn MC, and he did a live set with a jazz band this past summer.
Cool.
And so after the show, he went upstairs and signed CDs, and I waited in line for him to sign my CDs. And I was like, oh, this is my Comic-Con. Like, this is I admire these guys that can rap and put words together really well, make this great music. And so I'm a fan of that. Like, that's what I nerd out about.
Music is a genre of art I know even less about than film. I know a fair amount about film, amount, more than the average American my age, probably, about film. But music, less than the average American my age. Although I do have a pretty eclectic taste, I love to listen to it, but I can't talk about it. And if that conversation begins, I definitely bow out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, David Bowie died this week, and I was just like, I like his music.
Yeah, I thought he.
That's it.
I think he
I
was
like a, his music. That's yeah. it. I don't want to talk anymore about it.
Right.
That's how I feel. I don't know anything about it, and I feel embarrassed not knowing anything about such a, as you find out in their death, prolific artist.
Oh yeah,
innovative artist.
Well, I want to talk about your journey to how we get to Congers, New York. I want to talk about your dog. You basically have a bark silencer around your dog's neck.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we get to this baller lifestyle?
This wasteland.
No.
It all depends on your perspective. Actually, I feel that at this point in my life, I just turned 40 this year.
Congrats.
Thank you. I never could have imagined my career being as amazing as it's turned out to be, and my personal life even more being as just exceptional. I have mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of happiness for both where my career is at and where and the family that my wife and I built. I don't love this area. I don't love the community. I don't want to say anything insulting because I'm worried of offending people, but just because I don't. The truth is I don't have a lot in common with the average guy in my category, my age here.
Speak on that.
Well, you meet people when you're not from a place and you move to a place the way my wife and I did here, where we live in Rockland County, you meet people through your friend, your kids. Right. So you meet your kids' friends' parents, and those are the people you see them at practice or dance or at school and functions, and you just get to know each other. And then you meet your neighbors, and those are the people that you meet. And you're very cautious about socializing with your neighbors because you want to keep your life as mostly most people want to keep their life private, at least with they don't want their next door neighbors. Everybody knows how bad that can be.
Mm-hmm.
I just, Chris, have not found even, you know, one or two guys, just really no guys or and certainly not a group of guys that I clicked with, for lack of a better, you know, it's. And I haven't tried, and I don't kind of want to. That's the okay. thing that I've realized in therapy, and I've realized at this point, I socialize on my national radio show for 3 hours every day. Mm-hmm. I interview some of the smartest people in the world. I talk to the callers all for 3 hours, my producers. I talk for a living.
Right.
And I don't need to socialize with other adults up here. I like to socialize in my personal life. I like to spend time with people who I think generally elevate me somehow, spiritually, and anyway, as a husband and any role that I play as a father. You know, I have neighbors who have taught me how to take care of a home. You know, be a homeowner, mow my lawn. I mean, I learned some of these things growing up.
But, mow your lawn.
I knew how to mow my lawn.
Yeah.
I don't know why I use that as an example.
I know what you mean. But
I had to relearn after living. I lived in New York City for 12 years. I lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And that was, in many ways, I mean, that was my cultured period. That was where I met everyone.
And you met your wife, I'm assuming.
I met my wife in Europe, actually.
Oh, in Europe.
Yeah.
Oh, and, that's right. Well, before we get there, I kind of want to talk about, if you want to elaborate a little more about what your life is currently, you can do that. I don't want to derail that train, but I do want to talk about your childhood a little bit.
Well, watch this. I'll give you the 1 minute answer. I'm 40 years old. I'm married to my wife, Valerie, who I've been with for 15 years. We have two daughters, 11 and 8, Ava and Julia. They're the apple of my eye. They're my everything. I'm an activist father. I learn how to be a better father every day. I read books. I go to therapy. I go to marriage counseling. I exercise a lot. I try to keep very healthy, try to take good care of my family. That's the personal side. I have great work-life balance in my life. I host a national radio show 3 hours a day on Sirius XM from 9 to noon. It's my dream radio show. It's public interest combined with entertainment and comedy, and I want to do it the rest of my life. And of course, I am a stand-up comedian for 15 years, and I've done pretty much everything I've wanted to do in the world of stand-up comedy, but the only thing I don't want to do is ever stop putting out a new album this year.
Nice.
That's the 1 minute. 90 seconds? How long did that go?
I don't know. You didn't need to do that. You could
edit that out.
You could have taken your time. I mean, I wanted to know, because it doesn't seem like you're a misanthropic guy. You have a family and you talk to people. So I guess you get most of your social needs met through your
quote. When I'm not working, I want to be with my family.
Through your quote unquote work, which it doesn't seem like it's really work. It's just,
that's accurate,
and that's what everybody,
it's challenging. What I describe that I want in my life, and I think probably most people either relate to this or completely agree with it, is I want to be challenged every day. I want that. I guess most people may not want that. I don't know. I think most people probably do. I want to have reward from that challenge somehow, and I want it to be satisfying. And I want to be able to do that as long as I can every day. Have a rewarding, satisfying, challenging day. And that includes, you know, satisfying meals, challenging tasks, rewards, knowing that I, you know, from anything, from I listened well to my daughter and acknowledged her concerns, to I made a great point on my radio program today, or I made a phone call on behalf of somebody else to try to elevate his or her career. Like, something happened during this day. You know, what did I invest in my marriage today? I love it. I love getting up in the morning. I don't know too many people who love life more than I do. I'm addicted to life.
Now, were you always that way? How did you get there? Were these? I don't want to say. Well, you did say this was a bit of a dream job.
I had very little adversity in my life growing up.
Okay,
given the perspective that I know now about the world, my wife and so many people that I've met and been intimate with. I feel like my life was very good.
And when did you realize that?
Probably in college when I lived with guys who grew up in the Bronx and
okay.
were getting shot at.
Because you're from Syracuse,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, from kind of a rural suburban area outside Syracuse called Marcellus, New York, near the Finger Lakes. You know, I grew up water skiing. My dad was a ski instructor. We weren't wealthy, but we were, you know, for the first 7 years, actually, we were pretty poor. My dad owned an insurance agency. My mom went back to school and got a master's degree, and she was a public school teacher. And so we did well. We lived on a dead-end street, and it was real nice, Chris. It was a great childhood. My brother got into drugs and alcohol as an adolescent, and that was the hard thing. The hardest thing that happened for us was that. And for most families, that's probably a lot of times that's just Tuesday, or that's the best day. That's the worst.
Well, problem. Yeah. I mean, I lost a cousin to drugs, and he was the sweetest guy.
Mm.
He just got caught up in that life. Yeah. One of the nicest. I don't think my cousins really listen, but as far as older cousins are concerned, the sweetest guy, and it just. Life led him to get murdered.
Oh dear!
And it's one of those things where it's just like, oh well, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, like, that's exactly the choice I made. Exactly.
Yeah.
I never had a drop of alcohol until I was 22, and I was a jock. I mean, I was I was on a high school varsity soccer and lacrosse in college. Okay. I played lacrosse, but I just
where'd you go to college?
Well, college is in quotes. It is a college. It's a junior college. SUNY Cobleskill. It's not a 4-year school.
Okay.
It's a 2-year school. When I get in 2013, I had one of my proudest like life/career moments when they asked me to come back and give the commencement speech. So,
oh, that's amazing.
So I brag on that college now.
Yeah.
SUNY Cobleskill. I went there for 2 years, and then I moved to New York and studied acting for a couple of years. But that was an unaccredited conservatory theater program where the actors fucked the teachers, fucked the students. So that wasn't exactly the most professional atmosphere. Although sadly, I never got laid by a teacher.
Okay,
but I did have to kiss a guy in a play. 5th of July, Lanford Wilson. Just a pet.
Ah.
Toby Harrenshaw. We're still friends on Facebook.
What was his show?
Nice boy.
Burn This?
The kid I went to school with.
I'm thinking of Lanford Wilson.
Oh, Lanford. Yes, Burn This is Lanford Wilson.
Did he also have that show about the diner?
I don't know.
I think my school. Fuck.
I don't know.
That's going to fuck with me. Keep talking.
So I learned a lot about adversity in that college that I went to.
And, okay.
And, you know, I grew up with very little, I should say, diversity as well. I learned about adversity and diversity.
Okay.
And where I grew up, there was very little diversity, at least in terms of racially, religious, and then you could even add, like, you know, culturally. I mean, we had our fair share of hunters and rednecks, and we had our fair share of, you know, rich kids. We had a pretty good mix. But we were white, and we listened to Dave Matthews and U2, and we played lacrosse and soccer and baseball, basketball and football, and sports were Friday night, you know, football games were a big deal. So
sure.
It was upstate New York. It was like most of rural suburban America.
I think the farthest upstate I've been was Queensbury.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I loved it. I mean, I did a show.
Wait, where's Queensbury?
It's like maybe a half an hour above Albany.
Oh, all right. Yeah, yeah. Headed to Canada now.
Yeah. It's beautiful, and it was even
upstate New York is a beautiful place, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it's not. People think New York, they only think New York City. You've got everything from Buffalo to Syracuse, Rochester, Albany, and then you've got the Adirondack Mountains. You've got southwestern New York State, which is on the Pennsylvania border. And of course, you got New York City, Long Island, but the Capital District, Saratoga there. I just did an ad for Albany should thank me. You're welcome, Governor Cuomo.
Eat your heart out, Neil Patrick Harris.
There you go. I love Neil. He's on our channel at Sirius.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah, he was Duke Gowser. He was the man.
Yep.
But I loved, like, just last year doing shows up there and even the Berkshires, which is just beautiful, even in the off season when there's nothing going on, it's just a calming effect. I don't know. It's just always good for me to get away from the city.
Well, nature is how we're supposed to be as human beings. And when you when you connect with it, even when you don't know, I mean, I purposely connect with nature on a pretty daily basis. I mean, that's my kind of, I have this weird kind of religion, and not religion is a terrible word to describe it, but way of life where, you know, I'm very connected to the natural world, and I'm an environmentalist, and I'm supporting, you know, conservation and learning as much as I can about it. I talked to a lot of young people about it, and the idea that, you know, we're not getting outside, and our kids aren't getting outside, and that, you know, it's a huge problem, and I love it. It can change, as you're describing, your entire day.
Yeah.
A sunset, you know, anything. A snowflake, a leaf falling,
right.
A weird insect you've never seen. Love it.
I've mentioned this on
cry at it.
Oh, yeah. I've mentioned this on the show before, but just I had a gig in Saugerties, and I got there early. It was at like a VFW type place.
No need to brag on your own podcast
about me doing a VFW gig. All right, it paid well.
Yeah, I like a good VFW, an Elks Lodge, a PBA.
Yeah,
although I can't get away with a PBA anymore.
Shout out to Mike Spears who booked me on that. But and I got there early. I had maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours before the show, and I saw that they had a lighthouse, and I walked the trail, and it was beautiful. It was just, it was great.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and
it's how we're supposed to be.
Yeah, and period. It made me feel very calm and serene before the show.
I mean, I learned to meditate last year, and I don't do it every single day. But between that and nature, and combining the two, meditating in nature, that's a real natural high. Mm-hmm. Just sitting on a tree stump in the middle of the woods and closing your eyes and listening to your breath for as long as you can, trying to clear your mind. Oof.
So what you're saying is you shop at REI.
I do.
I do.
Patagonia, North Face, all those. I love it all. I'm a gearhead that way. I grew up skiing and snowboarding too. So
I've never been skiing.
Yeah. It's where I'm most racist.
Why?
Because if you see a black person on the mountain, you feel like they're probably not that good, and you want to keep your eye on them because you don't want them to crash into you. The worst thing. When you're as good as I am, you're only worried about people crashing into you and your kids.
Yeah.
And so you are extremely judgmental on the mountain. And so it's minorities,
though.
But it's also, if you see a white guy with his jacket unzipped and jeans, same thing.
Okay.
This guy may also break your leg. And so just keep your eye on him. And, you know, I will sometimes say, maybe you shouldn't be on this hill. Maybe you should go back to, you know, your hill.
Wow.
And then I also experienced bigotry for the first time as a white heterosexual male in America when I was a pioneer in the sport of snowboarding. And we were really looked down upon by the skiers. They did not want us there.
Oh, you were one of them.
That was my struggle.
Get off our hill.
You're scraping all the snow off with that snowboard. Get out of here, you radicals.
Wow.
You're probably bringing dope to the mountain. Yeah.
So this is pre-X Games?
It was the only time in my life where I ever felt like someone was really judging me for my, like, being a white heterosexual male, not Jewish. You know, there's no negative category that we've been
the
put
views
in.
Of Pete Dominic do not reflect the view. No, I'm just
right.
Yeah,
there's no negative category that you get put in, and so I never felt concerned about anything. And then when I was snowboarding, I'll never forget it. It was like, wow, this must be what it's like to be a woman.
Huh. Well, I mean, I can imagine. It doesn't seem like it's far-fetched. You know, I don't, because you would think as a white male, you don't have to, how do I say, you don't have to be concerned yeah. unless you want to.
I mean, overwhelmingly, we're not in a threat category. We have a pretty good damn life expectancy.
That's why I notice when some people, just friends that have podcasts, they happen to be white, or just they, when I hear them talk, they'll say, oh, but what if a white guy, it's like, nobody cares. It's just more people
there's
have
not a thing. More, it's a massive privilege to more, be a white male, and the idea that it's not, you can't debate that. You could be specific about a situation like, well, what if you're only white male on a basketball team in the Bronx? How easy is that? I'm like, all right, fine. You can have that.
I just think it's harder there. Well, but sports is a great equalizer, but at the
but
same,
it's not in a vacuum.
Sports No.
Life is as a white male in America and pretty much anywhere else in the world, as a white heterosexual male, I always like to include that because being gay or being confused, you know, being minimized in any way is different. You get picked on somehow, whether it's institutional or you know the guy next door.
I just think with the advent of social media and blogs and the internet, you're privy to more
voices. There's the dog. She's making noise. What does that mean? Is somebody here?
you're just privy to more voices.
Hold on a second.
Okay. Do you want to
stop? We're doing a podcast. You can't make any noise. Just calm down, Indy. This is going to make or break my career. You can't do this to Daddy. I have a family. Sit. It's okay. Shh.
I don't know.
All right.
Yeah, it's. I just noticed that it's like you're just getting more voices from other minorities that you normally wouldn't hear.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the case. It's always been the case. That's why I mean, it's, everything changes when you're exposed to people that you don't know. It's the most basic. You don't have to be a psychologist to figure that out. I mean,
that's fine. If she's not hurt, it's okay.
Dog whining on the podcast. This is terrible. Who's going to want to listen to this? Press pause. I'll put her in the thing.
Okay.
I mean, the idea that. The dog.
She came out.
No, they're fine.
It's fine if she, as long as she's not
downstairs.
Okay. All right.
I don't know how anybody can really. There are certain things that just are and aren't. There's not two sides to every everything. There's not two sides to the argument that there is a privilege to be white. There's a privilege to be a man. There's privilege to be heterosexual. The idea that everybody's equal is a canard, obviously. I mean, it's just we can talk about how we got there, but certainly
sure.
It's better to be a white guy still in 2015-16 America, and I'll take on that argument with anybody because I'm happy to. It's easy.
It's almost a hack joke when comedians will say, I've heard more than one comedian say like, oh, I saw a white homeless guy, you didn't use your superpowers, you know, like that sort of thing. That's kind of a generalization,
yeah.
But you know, but it's kind of like, what are you doing? Like when I visited San Francisco, I was walking around with some friends, and I saw this kid with he's just scruffy, not really, you know, he's probably away from his family, but he was just kind of a scruffy kid. Like if he just had a shower, he'd be okay. It's like, dude, go home.
You can't know someone's story.
You can't.
White people have all kinds of problems. We do, absolutely. But the bottom line is what you're saying is if that kid put a suit on and shaved and you, looking the way you do today, had a suit on and shaved, and if he didn't have any college and you had 4 years at an Ivy League, he still in America in 2016 has an advantage. That's actually been proven in social science. Blacks with college degrees still don't do as well as whites without.
Mm-hmm.
And there are exceptions, but overwhelmingly, that is the case. It's just the case. It's where we're at. We're getting better very slowly. We take 3 steps forward, 2, sometimes 4 steps back, but we're
Tyler Perry movie comes out, 6 steps back, and then, no, I'm just fucking. but it's like.
And an Ice Cube movie comes out and 2 steps forward. Or we stay neutral.
Right along too in theaters.
You know, here's the most patronizing thing I realize. I code switch sometimes. I realize when I talk to people, people, women, older people. I'm good at kind of adapting, but I try very hard not to. But one thing I realize, and this is a joke I'm doing now in my stand up, is we are having. If I'm talking to like a black guy about movies, like we always like to talk about movies, I wouldn't do this to you because you have such eclectic taste and I know you well, and he can't categorize you racially, I don't think. But I'll be like, one of my favorite movies of all time, Boys in the Hood. But I feel like if I'm talking to white people, it's like Platoon or Shawshank. Although Dances with Wolves, I'm like almost to fit in and to be accepted into the conversation. Or I'll give you something that we can talk about.
Sure.
And I do that especially with my tastes and things.
I could see that. I think we do that to a certain degree. I know most minorities have to do that.
Yeah, of course they do. That's why it's weird when I get called out for that. My producer calls me out for it, and it's fair.
When you
it's
say like you like out. A.
No, he's like, you code switch. Like, you talk a little differently. Even, like, he says, I'll have an accent on my voice or something if I'm talking to a black guy or something. I'm like, I don't – and there might be that. And if it is
– I don't notice it. I don't notice
it
now.
I'm not doing it with you, clearly. But yeah, don't I'm in my home. I'm gonna, like, you're, it would be you're even worse if I did it here. But and I don't – whatever. I don't – but I don't think it's – I don't think it's a, the most phony, terrible, hypocritical thing to do to be able to adapt, you know, if it's very subtle, especially. And I mean, you do that with senior citizens. Yeah. You're not gonna, I'm not going to walk into my grandmother's house and start, you know, dropping jokes about my balls.
Right.
But, you know, I am in a comedy club on a Saturday night, third show. I mean, like, it depends on who your audience is on and off stage with how you talk about them, how you treat them. And it's not about, you know, offending anybody. It's just like, hey, this it'll go better if we behave in this way.
Yeah,
it's, just, it's a poor defense of phony.
I think it seems like in your case, it's almost to. It seems like the main goal is to forge a connection.
Yeah, it's always to forge a connection. What can we talk about? What can we talk about that I can learn from? That I can become a better person? And it's not being – some people like I'm always the same in every situation and I am who I am. And I'm fine with that too. If you want to get a tattoo on your face, whatever. You want to wear – you're a dude who wants to wear a skirt. And I don't mean transgender. I mean like you're a straight – you're a white guy who likes to wear skirts and combat boots to just show how he rages against the machine. Fine. That's fine too. But man, I'm telling you, I like to have really thought provoking conversations and I don't even know what I'm saying at this point. I don't know why I do it. I really think this became therapy. Am I high?
Would you just had, what did you have? A Bud Light or a Coors?
I did have a Coors.
These are actually good. Yeah. I haven't had one in a long
beer
time.
Beer out of a glass, Chris. You ever drink beer out of a frosted glass? Some guy
told me that before.
2 years ago. I'm 40 years old and I never did that. I don't have a lot of experience with drinking.
I'm not a big drinker either because it's like alcoholism and the family and stuff, both sides. But
oh man,
when I do, like, I'll go for I like Killian's Irish Red, Blue Moon.
Now you won't go buy a beer and have it in your house.
Sometimes
you'll buy a six pack.
Yeah,
I didn't do that until I moved to the burbs out here in the wasteland. I never had a six pack of beer in my New York City apartment, bachelor, and then life with my wife, and then our first daughter was born there. She was two when we moved up here.
Yeah,
like everything was different. The lifestyle is different than here. You know, here you buy groceries and you have a car and you drive to and from, you know, all kinds of different things. And in New York, you ride the subway. It's a totally different lifestyle. But one definite change I made was beer and buying beer and having pot in the garage if I needed it.
Mm. It would stay. Like it would just – if I bought a 6 or 12 pack.
Nobody's
12,
touching it.
It would be a long time unless I had friends over. If a lady comes over, you
have
what
a beer.
What does she like to drink?
She like a beer, ma'am.
Yeah.
You offer a beer to a lady when she comes over?
It depends on – if I know her, I'll ask her what she likes to drink.
You know what I hated when I was little is when this one kid whose name was also Chris would come to my house and I'd be like, hey, man, do you want a fudgesicle? And he would be like, I'll have one if you have one. I'm like, dude, I mean, I'm not having one. I'm going to have – something else, but you need to be confident enough to be able to say I do or I don't want a fudgesicle.
I kind of did that with you.
And I feel like when I was at Kennedy and we came in here, you're like, I offered you a drink because we're in my house. I'm like, I had coffee brewing. Maybe, I don't know if you drink. Uh-huh. I said, you can have coffee or a glass of wine. I've got beer. You can have a, you know, but you know, you're doing a podcast. So I figured
you kind of after school specialed me.
I did.
You're like, it's Friday night, man.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's Friday. Yeah. Sometimes if I would get takeout from somewhere, like if I go to Hooters or something, I'll get a tall, like Blue Moon or something.
Mm, I like that.
And it's good. Like it gives you work all day and you're like, I like it.
Blue Moon after a day on the mountain skiing.
Mm,
that's good. After a day of cold outside.
Of dodging black people.
After a day of making sure I see any blacks at all. And any whites with their jacket open wearing jeans on the mountain, those are two people you want to avoid.
That's good to know.
I mean, once you get down to the bottom of the mountain, you become not racist anymore and be like, can I help you? Why don't you go ahead of me in line?
I think somebody was
metaphorically
saying...
metaphorically and literally.
It's a... what did somebody say? That's something that's kind of like a... it's not a litmus test, but it's just something... it's a almost like a survival tactic. Not necessarily to a high level, I'm going to die, but it's just like, I know this checklist, this mental checklist, I may be this... feel this... I may come off as being racist by going through this checklist, mm-hmm. but these prejudices or things that I have.
See, I am going to go ahead and defend it on the mountain, my bigotry, because if you are in an elevator and a black guy gets in and you clutch your purse, that's straight up irrational fear.
Yeah.
That's just stupid bigotry. Or any other kind of answer like that. If you don't want your kid to date a person of color, that's straight up bigotry. But if I see a black guy at Hunter Mountain on a black diamond, that's the toughest,
okay,
most difficult. I'm not taking my eye off him until he gets ahead of me. If he's behind me, that's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah.
I let him get ahead of me.
It's not about your wallet. It's about your life.
Oh, no. I keep my hand in my wallet as well because the blacks on the mountain...
hilarious.
They're only really up there to steal from the richest and most elite of athletes.
Oh, my God.
But to be fair, it's not just skin color. If I see a white guy who's got jeans on, it's the exact same
That's a bit.
Thing.
Are you doing that on stage?
No,
you
I haven't.
You
because
should.
I don't feel like enough people can relate to that. It's a skiing. It's a skier's thing. If I was doing a gig at a ski mountain, yeah, I'm delivering that. I'd put that out there.
A bit, man.
Yeah, you think it works?
People in this area, North Jersey.
But I wonder if it's a bit,
even
if you don't ski. Like, I would do that to an all black audience, and I think I'd be good.
I think black people would like it.
I saw once, if we're still talking about black people at ski areas, a black guy walking down a black diamond run, which is the most difficult. Most difficult is black diamond.
Why?
He was walking down, you know, carrying the rental equipment.
Okay.
And he was just cursing that I ain't going on this hill. I don't know how they got me on this hill.
Okay.
You know, and it was just the funniest thing in the world because that guy, you know, he's just being real. He's just being honest. He's like, yeah. I'm not crazy. I'm not going down this motherfucking hill. And it was the greatest.
Yeah, that's a bit.
I was
that's
like,
a
thank
chunk.
You.
That's a chunk.
I was like, thank you for being, now I don't have to worry about that guy. He's just walking down. He's good.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah, I think you should do that. That should be on the album.
When you have kids, too, you worry about them. There's someone running into them. That's really all you
There was some famous person, some actor that said when you have kids, they're like your heartbeats outside of you.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's
I don't know if it was Richard Dreyfuss or
Richard Gere.
Or I don't know if it was Richard Gere.
Or
I don't remember who said it.
Yeah. Could have been another Richard. Richard Kind.
Or it was Dustin Hoffman. I don't remember, but it was one of those old guys. Let's talk about a little bit about comedy. Do you feel like you have to code shift in different rooms or
really you think career, so? I've been code shifting. Oh my gosh. I've made so much money code shifting. I'm a chameleon. I sell whatever the audience wants. I can perform at any gig. I'm highly bookable. You name it.
Name the gig.
I've done it.
I enjoyed
and I've been paid for it.
I think the hardest gigs that I've ever done were those brunch shows.
Kids shows I've done.
Yeah. You do them well.
I used to make $50 a kid show when I lived in New York City. These camps, we call them camp shows, and they would come in, and yeah, you just yep.
But you still don't. But I think it's
different material. It's different behavior. It's different. It's different timing. It's all different.
But I think the way you're describing it is almost just like I don't sense that you're losing your essence. I don't think Pete's.
No, I always keep. I appreciate that. I think I do always keep the essence of who I am. I've warmed up the audiences for television shows for years.
What shows?
Made a fortune doing that. The Colbert Report for 6 years.
Really?
The Daily Show before that, and before that, all kinds of different pilots you've never heard of, all kinds of different shows that you have.
Isn't that a different skill?
It is. I learned so much there with that. It was improv, really. It's mm-hmm. in the moment, and so I'm able to take that skill to anything from kid shows to nonprofits to corporate gigs to colleges, and whatever I'm doing, and even the television and radio. I mean, that just being in the moment is appealing to any person, period.
What's different about doing a set at Levity than doing the Daily Show?
Like, well, for the Daily Show, they've come to see the Daily Show, and you're just in the way. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. It's like being an opening act at a comedy club, but you know,
how do you fight that?
You convince them that they need that you're hilarious. You do that pretty quick. You establish credibility, and then it's just destruction.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's mostly improv. It's mostly what you'd call audience or crowd work, but not so typical. You know, I try to stay atypical. I try to be different every night just to make the camera guys laugh. I mean, I did it for 6 years at the Colbert Report.
That's always been a gauge for me, like as an actor and even as a comedian working a club, just during the rehearsal process, there's nobody there except you, the cast and the crew. Mm-hmm. And if you can make them laugh because they've seen you so many times, or you can find something new, that's when I knew a performance was getting to where I needed to be.
I would most compare myself in terms of my essence, my skill set, to Robin Williams. Like that kind of manic improv, adapt to the moment, not fearless.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never say I'm as funny as Robin Williams. I'll never say even the material. I mean, I'm pretty proud of a lot of my act, but you know, never compare myself to him, but that's the style that I think probably I fit in.
Not as manic though, but
as manic for sure. But I mean, I'll go, if you're doing like a local TV to promote stand up type of thing, like you're in Cleveland, you're headlining the hilarities and you do the local affiliate, I'm the guy who'll go in there and the anchor won't even get a question in. I just barrel through that. That's mine. He's not setting me up for anything but failure. So I'm just coming.
How do you figure that he's just there to set you up?
He doesn't know how.
He doesn't know how.
He doesn't know how to interview a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
So what? What was your inspiration? I mean, why comedy? And who are your inspiration? I mean, come on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm not answering those questions. Those aren't fun to answer. They're not entertaining. Well, you know, Robin Williams was always my inspiration, Mike. I appreciate you asking me. No, just be who you are. And that's how I've, you know, conducted my career, whether it's with an agent or manager or everybody in at SiriusXM where I work. If I'm in your office, I'm going to be me and be funny. I'm not going to be, you know, unless obviously it's not always appropriate, but you don't want to be obnoxious, but you know, you be who you are in any situation. And that's always worked for me.
Cause one thing I enjoy about you is not only you just being malleable to the audience and at the same time maintaining your essence, is just the fact that what I'm struggling or just working towards is being more lucid on stage. Just like letting, when we worked together Christmas weekend, there was a guy in the front row. Was his name Israel?
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
you buried
the lead, but yeah.
Yeah. What was his deal?
This is a guy that just looked like a typical, like if you were casting a terrorist, an Islamic terrorist.
Yeah.
Like if you were making a movie about ISIS, this guy would be your Jihad John. He was a brown skinned guy with a big, thick, like chin strap, black beard.
Yeah.
And he had tattoos. He just looked badass. You know? And I called him ISIS and a terrorist and made a big deal about him not getting through an airport and what a struggle it must be for him.
Yeah.
And why would he can make different choices about the way he looks. Why wouldn't he? And I go, you know, why put yourself in that? You know, we are an ignorant bunch. We're an ignorant bunch. And I see you, that guy, I'm like, listen, if I'm TSA, you're not getting on this plane.
Right.
And he could speak with a, you know, the accent of William F. Buckley. I'm like, well, I am getting on this plane. I am an educated man. I'm like, no, look at you. Yeah. This guy looked right out of Central Casting ISIS. And I said all those things to him. And I said, what's your name, by the way? Because you're a good sport. He was being so cool, you know. And he goes, my name is Israel. And that was that.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew at that moment there's nothing that was going to happen on stage that would have been better than that. I knew I peaked. That was it. That was almost sad for me.
That was like kind of like 20 minutes in.
Not even. It was 10 minutes in. Around that time. And it was, as a comic, I knew that was it. That was all. That was the best thing that was going to happen. And yeah. I just struggled through the rest of the set trying to get back to that peak.
Yeah.
And knowing I'll never come close.
But it was
such a beautiful, beautiful moment.
Yeah,
it was just
yeah.
a gift. And there's rarely, in my opinion, there's rarely material from any comedian that can match an audience making the exact same discovery and laughing at the exact same thing together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's like an orgasm with your partner at the same time. That's how you feel. We're all in this. We all experience this. There's nothing better than this. Good luck with your prepared shit, buddy.
How do you learn how to take advantage of those gifts? Like, do you just recognize it? Is it just being part of being lucid, engaged?
There's a whole bunch of tricks, man.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of tricks, for sure.
I don't feel like it's tricks. Do you feel like that's the right term?
Yeah, because the tricks come in be able to think seven moves ahead. When you're
talking, when you're
a stand-up comic talking to an audience member and you want to be good at it, and I'm one of the best, if I do say so myself, and there's a lot of good guys, but you have to be able to – you train your brain to think seven steps ahead or so, or at least three. Knowing if I say this, they're going to say one of these three things, and then I'm going to say something like this. And then they might stay in it, they might not. I mean, I was at the Detroit Comedy Castle, which is one of the best comedy clubs in America, this past week doing a guest spot with the great Andy Hendrickson, just a phenomenal comedian. And long story short, this woman in the front row ended up throwing a stick of chapstick at me, and it was awesome. It was great.
Why
it was super
did she
entertaining.
Throw chapstick at you?
Because I took her chapstick and made fun of it. What is this? Birds, bees? As you've seen me do, take things. I take people's property.
Yeah, you took somebody's jacket.
I put on a woman's jacket at the beginning of a set. She wasn't there. It was the front middle table, and they weren't there when the headliner comes on. How dare you? So I reached down, and I was like, where are these people? The audience is packed, and there was just one table in the front. So I just picked up the woman's jacket, and I put it on, and it was tiny on me. And she came back. And the whole audience is in on the joke except for her and her friend, who went to shit with her, apparently. I don't know. Women shit together.
Well,
go
ahead. Continue.
Yeah, I mean, you got to know how that's going to go. You want to have been in the situation, something similar to it, but you know how it's going to go because you've been there. You're able to – it's a really interesting – I probably should have a PhD in being able to read – a group, an audience, and know how they feel, what they're thinking, where they are at, what's the weather like outside, was there a mass shooting today, you know, where is this mood? Because I did it for so long at the Colbert Report every night and so many other television shows, and as an MC in New York City and in my act, I always have been a big crowd guy.
So
it used to be more less respected, actually. It used to be more hacky. And now you have great respected comedians coming out with full, like Todd Barry, who's a prolific writer. Now he's got a whole like CD with just crowd work. I was like, if I knew you could do that. But kudos to him, man.
Well, see, now there's three or four different ways that I want to go with this conversation. Because you say
I hope one of them involves taking my pants off. What?
We'll edit that out.
Whatever.
You touched on being able to do the crowd work, having, you know, being able to think seven steps ahead, but then you also mentioned the fact that people look down on that.
There was a time
your peers did.
I mean, people still do if it's going to ruin the headliner set or the next guy. People don't want to go up after Lee Scalampanelli, Pete Dominic, or Jessica Kirsten because we're doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when we talk to the audience, it's something different than they're doing. They don't want to talk to the audience, and they shouldn't have to. But after a guy's been talking to the audience, the audience then expects the next guy to talk to
do the same thing,
and the next guy wants to be like, dude, I didn't start a conversation with you. And I don't want to. I'm Louis C.K. I'm Jim Gaffigan. I don't need to do that. I don't want to do that. I got the best jokes in the world. I just want to do my jokes.
Yeah.
And that's I think that's fine and fair, that way of thinking.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to do what I'm good at because they don't do that. I'm not maybe as good of a writer, but I'm as good of a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to perform.
Now, when you're coming up, are you coming up in rooms where you're mainly doing these showcase shows in the city?
Yep. All the New York City comedy clubs, every one of them, you know, 5-10 comedians a night.
And you start, you were 24?
I was 20.
20 years old?
Yep, yep.
So we're talking...
My New York City...
95?
Late 90s, 99.
Okay.
Really. 95 is when I moved to New York, but I really was studying acting. I didn't really get, you know, start full-time pursuing stand-up to like 97, 98.
Did that seem like a natural progression for you since, as a kid, you were... The superhero who was trying to...
The reason I'm a comedian is because it was my job to make everybody happy and laugh if they were fighting in my family. And, you know, I still sometimes fall into that.
Because it seems like there... I think you always... Do you find when you're around your family, like you sometimes fall into the role that you had when
Less
you...
Less so now, only because I'm so... I've gone through a lot of therapy and dealt with that. And it can't be my responsibility anymore to make my mom or my dad or my brother or any, you know, I have a family of my own now.
Right.
So I'm a little bit more ruthless with my own parents and brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a little bit more honest.
Well, that's understandable.
I guess. I don't know. It would be easier if I wasn't.
Well, so basically, because it seems like there's a, even though there's obviously a joy that seems to come across when you're doing what you do, there also seems to be diligence as well, you know, but not like it's like I'm doing this and I'm working hard at making you laugh, but it's just like it just seems like it's
you
the more I talk to you,
being
just
on
like,
stage with my stand-up, or in general as a human, you mean there's a diligence to the performance,
the craft.
On stand-up.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, there's a real goal every time I'm on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to grow at best, and to do what they're paying me for at the least. So if I just have to rely on old material that I know is going to work because they're paying me, you know, especially if you're headlining, obviously. But I mean, if you're just working out, then those expectations aren't as high, and you can try out a lot more material, and you can take risks. But I know also that I can go on stage and not do any material for as much as, you know, an hour, sometimes more, and probably have sometimes the best sets of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, weave the material in when needed.
Yeah.
So it gets me to the next conversation with somebody in the audience, or the next kind of improvised, you know, situation somehow or another. You
right.
know? There's always a goal. There's always a goal, and it's to grow, really, is the main goal.
What about...
So I hate doing old stuff because you're not growing.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed of it.
Oh, you're ashamed
of it? I'm ashamed of if I do a joke that's really old. It makes me feel really, really terrible at this point in my career. But I haven't had the ability to work on my stand-up act and my material because I have a full-time other dream job, which is, you know, my SiriusXM radio show. So I'm not out as much. I understand that I need to forgive myself for not pumping out as much material because I don't get to be on stage as much as I'd like, obviously. I have a family and I have a great radio show. And
what were the early years like for you? So you're starting in the late 90s in New York City. What's around? Like, who did you start
comedians?
With? Yeah, like...
Oh, my gosh.
Cause you, weren't,
so
you
many
a,
greats.
Weren't you a personal trainer?
Yeah, I was a personal trainer for 7 years, and I slowly, you know, weaned away from that and to more stand-up. And I remember when I literally quit, the day I fully quit, I only had, like, two clients left as personal trainer because most of my income was coming from stand-up, was when Artie Lang called me up. I was like, yeah, can you open for me in Cleveland and Detroit? I'll give you $1,500 apiece. You'll just do, like, 7 minutes.
Jesus.
And I was like, yep. And I quit personal training because that was like $3,000 and, you know, one, you know. But I mean, I did well making money doing colleges, and I was able to support myself pretty well doing comedy at colleges, New York comedy clubs in and around New York, and then all the clubs in New York. I mean, I worked every night. And then I also did the warm-up pretty early on in my career at some really shitty shows, but it paid well. Mm-hmm. So, but the comics that I was out there that were, you know, I'm trying to think, I'll leave people out that are super famous.
Why would you leave them out?
Because I'll just forget.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But like, who are the guys, who are the people now that are just, I mean, Gaffigan was out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa Lampanelli, I opened for her for a long time. She's a close personal friend of mine who I adore. Amy Schumer, the first show she ever did. I've been doing comedy probably 7-8 years, and I was hosting a new talent show
at Gotham.
Okay. That was one of the first shows she ever did. Amy and I became really good friends for a while, and then she got, you know, super famous. Nothing happened, but
but I have a family. And but so many other greats. I mean, you name it. I mean, all the guys on Tough Crowd when that show, those were the guys that were the upperclassmen to me. Greg Giraldo was my favorite comic, and we became very good friends, and sadly we lost him in 2010. But Greg Rogel, Greg Fitzsimmons, the Gregs.
Patrice and Burr.
Yeah, I mean, I love Patrice comedy, and I got to be pretty good friends with him. But I saw, hate to speak poorly of someone who's passed, but I saw the way he treated a lot of people, and Patrice is like, you know, you had to be right in. Bill Burr was one of my closest friends for a long time, and Jim Jeffries. Mm-hmm. I didn't come up with Jim, but I'm starting to name comics who I love and who I've worked with. But there are so many great comedians: Caroline Ray, Judy Gold, Karen Bergreen. I mean, there's a whole bunch of women that I came up with. Aaron Foley, and then I guess my closest friends: Joe Matarese,
yeah, love Joe,
and Nick DiPaolo. Always one of my favorites. So these guys were more juniors and seniors when I was a freshman, as I like to look at it.
Right.
But Zach Galifianakis was – I hung out with him every night for a long time at Stand Up New York, and Ed Helms. I can go on and on. I was out at the comedy clubs every night. I know every comedian, too, from not only coming up in New York and emceeing at so many clubs. I was emceeing at the Comedy Cellar and the Comic Strip and Stand Up New York and Dangerfields and Caroline's and Gotham. And then I had a Sirius XM show where I was on the Comedy Channel interviewing comedians. So, I mean, I probably know as many comedians as anybody in the business, and I love that fact.
Can you speak on being an MC? Because I think a lot of people don't know that that's probably one of the hardest jobs to do as a comic.
It's an easier, far easier job when the lineup of comedians is great. So if it's a Friday or Saturday night in New York City, it's the easiest job in the world, which is the weird thing that, you know, at one time a pretty well-respected comedy club booker said, I don't know if you're ready to host on the weekends. And I explained to him how comedy worked. I'm like, let me explain to you how comedy works, which is really patronizing to say to a comedy booker. I said, it's really very hard, almost impossible, to do a good job emceeing a new talent night, because you have to actually come up and bring the audience back after they've just seen the most awkward, cringeworthy performance, and often it's their friend or family.
Right.
That's hard, bringing the audience back and setting them up for the next person to fail. That's hard to do over and over, 10 comedians, 2 hours, an audience that just wants to go home on a Wednesday night. That's hard. What's not hard is hosting 5 of the best comedians in the country on a Saturday night. That's easy. And that is a good way of explaining, you know, the difficulty, the range of difficulty with emceeing. It all depends on how good the comedians are on the show. And you want to set them up at the very beginning. And I had a really good reputation. Comedians would show up at the club, see I was emceeing, and be happy because they knew I was going to give them the best audience I could. And I was going to carry that like a little baby, take care of it for my 10 minutes, and then hand that audience off to them as best I could.
Do you think that's missing with younger comics now? Because it kind of seems like They don't want to host, or
I think younger comics are more focused on writing than they are performing, and they're more if I'm going to generalize, they're more afraid to fail, and it's easier to fail with crowd work, and they probably don't even respect it. Again, I mean, some guys maybe, but I'm not out there as much to see who a good MC is or how they see that role. But I was always really proud of how good I was at it and how much respect I got for it from some of the best comedians in the business. I mean, I keep naming names: Jim Florentine, Jim Norton.
Yeah,
you know, there's just so many guys that I came up watching or came up with, and that I have such a great deal of respect for so many of them.
This is nerdy and a little bit me being a bit of a student, if you will, but what were some of the struggles you had coming up?
I felt like nobody would, I felt like I kept slipping through the cracks. I was like, why is that guy getting passed at the comic strip or the Comedy Cellar, not me? Why is that guy getting a Montreal Comedy Festival and not me? I had a chip on my shoulder for a while, I think, for the first few years, and that I felt like I was getting. But then I really did start getting mine. I got past at the Comedy Cellar and the comic strip, and I just kept knocking down the goals that I had. But I felt like I should. I felt like my talent wasn't as recognized by agents and managers and club bookers as it should have been. Mm-hmm. That was the chip on my shoulder. But I got my recognition when I deserved it, probably, mm-hmm. you know, arguably.
I feel
because
that
I would
sometimes.
Kill,
yeah.
but my material might not have been as good as the next guy who might not kill as much, but his material was a little bit more original, or his delivery was a little bit more tweaked than mine, and mine was a little bit too unoriginal or too mainstream. It was never you have to have comedian mentor friends, and that's hard to establish, but you got to have a guy that can be like, dude, that's hack. You can't do that. It's unoriginal. Everybody's done that joke. You have to have that guy who, as I always called it, and Joe Matarese was always that guy for me, mm-hmm. who can de-hack your set.
Yeah.
You know, who could tell you, don't do that, you know. And if you don't have that person, you'll continue to stay in that lane of mediocrity, I guess.
Yeah.
You'll get work, but you got to be original. You got to have something to say so that you stand out somehow from the last guy.
I feel like some of that I struggle with. How come this guy? It's almost like how come that guy, but it's not even, I don't lose sleep over it, but I sometimes just look at it as, well, I just got to keep working and keep getting.
I mean, that's really the bottom line. Like, you can always get specific advice from people who are familiar with what you're doing on stage, but the bottom line is to just keep getting up on stage and experimenting. With material, with delivery, with you know, even with your clothes, your look, you know, mm-hmm. Within reason, I suppose. I mean, I get a little judgmental on that. But, I mean, when I would do college showcases, I would always wear a superhero shirt. So then when they would come to buy us, they would literally buy us like we were at a meat market.
Sure.
They would remember, oh, there he is. You know, and then once I lost my hair, I became the bald guy. So that was not an issue. But, you know, you don't want to look like exactly like every other white guy. I didn't say anything about superheroes in my act. I didn't reference the shirt. It was just a way of being like, I'm this guy.
Yeah.
He's that guy. Because maybe my act didn't separate itself enough. Maybe my look didn't mm-hmm. separate itself enough, so that you can always change something, tweak something.
Yeah.
But if you find your voice early, then you just want to keep adding, you know, that new jokes, new material.
Were there things craft wise that you had to overcome, like being able to open up more? Because your material now is autobiographical.
I never had
a filter.
No.
You never. Okay.
No. I mean, I was never too really, really dirty, but I mean, at the same time, I do have some jokes in my act that you would consider pretty dirty, but they're usually scatological or sexual, and they're usually autobiographical. So I don't care.
Yeah.
If you know, I have a joke in my act about my dog licking my asshole while I'm having sex with my wife, and that's a thing that happened.
Yeah,
I didn't make any of it up.
So it's not even whether it's blue or clean, but it's just
is it appropriate for this performance? If I'm hosting something for Verizon, I'm not doing it. If I'm warming up an audience of a TV show, I'm not doing it. But if it's a comedy club on a Saturday night in most of the country, and it's even the early show on a Saturday night, yeah, I'm doing that because it's a thing that happened.
Right.
So I'm going to tell you about it.
Now,
I hope it's a thing that happens again.
Talk, Indy. Talk a little bit.
Which reminds me, could we wrap this up? I got to stuff some dog food in my keister, Chris.
We'll wrap it up.
No, I'm kidding, man. Whatever you want to do.
We'll wrap it up.
My family's not here.
Yeah, we're okay. I just wanted to know a little bit.
Talk about comedy for hours because I don't get to enough.
Oh, you don't?
No, not anymore. I mean, it used to be the only thing I talked about all the time.
Talk about your wife. Talk about meeting your wife and how, if it has at all enhanced what you do as an artist, you know, how did it help you? When did you meet your wife?
I met my wife in the summer of 2000 when we were both backpacking through Europe.
Okay.
Doing the Eurorail thing, staying at hostels, you know, in a budget of like $1,000 for 4 weeks or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then just borrowing money just so you could stay out for another couple days. And we met there. She was in Chicago, living in Chicago. I was living in New York. We did long distance for 8 months. She moved to New York when she got into grad school. She got pregnant from my penis in 2005. mm-hmm. then we when my daughter was two, we moved to the burbs, and the rest is probably pretty boring, but not to me,
right.
to anybody listening. But so as far as how she's influenced me as an artist, it's more how she's influenced me as a man, and she's just always insisted that I grow up in terms of being more responsible, you know, paying off my credit cards, making sure I have work, treating a lot of comedians never mature as in terms of understanding what a career is, what a career trajectory is, where do you want to be, you know, how are you charting this out? Because we're not always the most responsible, professional, or even intelligent people. We get a lot of credit for intelligence. Not always the case. You mm-hmm. have intelligence as humor, and maybe you're very perceptive, but you're not responsible. I know a lot of comedians. You know, you mentioned Patrice O'Neill. He, that guy was one of the funniest guys in the world, but he didn't know how to book an airplane flight. Like, he just let his managers do that. Like, there are guys, you're just lazy. You know, you didn't mm-hmm. do certain things. I've always been a guy who's pretty career focused. I knew I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, and that's the only thing I wanted to be. And if something else came, great. But my wife really incentivized me into working more because we needed the money. So more than anything yeah. else, you know, it really is that. Be responsible, work hard, don't make excuses for your failure, period. That's it. Go to work. It's time to go to work. And I love it. I love the idea that I support my family telling jokes.
Talk a little bit about the radio show. Like, how do you got into that?
Because
you mentioned you were interviewing comics
I got hired at SiriusXM to host a show on the Comedy Channel, and I had auditioned against a bunch of other comedians, and they hired me, and it was away in the SiriusXM, and that show every day was 1 hour where it was a national radio show where I took calls from listeners all over the country for their request for what comedian to play, and I had the whole library, and I would play them. But I took the calls, and I treated that like crowd work. Mm-hmm. And every day I'd have a topic, like, you know, if you ever shit your pants as an adult in public or anywhere else, give us a call. Screen the best ones, put them on. I go back and forth with them. Then I began interviewing comedians and other entertainers, actors, actresses. And I did that for a couple of years, but then I really wanted, as I became more mature father, I really wanted to do something more important than that.
Right.
And that's when I pitched this 3-hour radio show, which is now in its fourth iteration and final iteration, I hope. I mean, it'll always develop and change, but the name of the show and the channel that it's on, I hope won't. And it is, it gives me a lot more satisfaction than comedy. My ego finally ran out, meaning like, all right, enough. I have enough accolades, enough compliments in terms of you're funny. Now I want that positive feedback in terms of you're doing something good impacting the world.
How did you know you had enough of that?
It's a great question, because I realized that it didn't matter except for my own kind of self-esteem, my own ego, that you get to a certain point in life where you start to understand what an ego is and how fragile it is and how it serves you often very poorly. And then you realize maybe you just want to be happy. And that's maybe a false source of happiness, a phony source of happiness, all those compliments, you know, that you're funny. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I could never do that. Yeah, it's because you don't need to, all right?
Yeah,
so that's the secret. But the answer is, how did I know? When I became a father, I realized when I was out headlining the comedy club, I'd always wanted a headline. Most people probably haven't heard of it. It's in El Paso, Texas. I think it's called Bart's Comic Strip. And it was a Thursday night, and I was headlining a comedy club, and that's all I ever wanted, Chris. And I realized, you know what? I want to be home with my daughter, who was at the time like 6 months old. And I said, I still have a journal entry about this. I said, I'd rather be a custodian cleaning a kid's cafeteria at an elementary school than doing stand-up and having to be away from my family. And so that was really where I said, I want to be able to stay in town and still do this and do other things. And I want those things to be valuable. I want my daughters to look at their father and say, you know, he was a great role model. And he did
here.
Something.
He
took, yeah, of course, that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was present for us, but he took seriously his journey in life and wanted to do something, add something to the world that was good through his work and through us, you know, through my daughters. And that's when I started, you know, really understand what I wanted to do and started hosting this show that I host, which is really just NPR with a personality, public interest. Mm-hmm. We talk about family, race, religion, politics, science, parenting, everything. And we have fun with them all.
That's great. So what, can you stand up with Pete Dominic on Sirius?
Yeah, it's on Sirius XM every day, 9 to noon. The channel is the Insight Channel, which I created. I actually pitched the channel, and the company said we love it, and we did it.
What's the? Is there a number?
Channel 121.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Pete, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in my home, and it was fun. Hopefully people get something from it.
All right. Take it easy, everybody.